Let's welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. He's the former executive director of the NHLPA, and he's a partner at Jackson Lewis LLP Law Firm in Boston. Paul Kelly, thanks very much for joining us. Happy Thanksgiving, and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, pleased that you're able to join us on this Saturday afternoon. Paul, you know, obviously we're, you know, being a hockey show, all we've been able to talk about for the last number of months has been the CBA and the CBA negotiations. Let's start with this question. You know, are you surprised that history might be repeating itself?
Well, both surprised and disappointed, frankly. You know, where the last time around in 2004-05, you know, the parties were talking about a complete system change, it didn't surprise a lot of us that, you know, you lost the entire season. But here, you're not talking about that type of a radical change. You're really only talking about, you know, the division of the, you know, vast revenues as well as some contract issues. And you would have thought or hoped that the parties would have been able to work it out and recognize the damage that losing, number one, what you've already lost, which is almost half a season, and the prospect of losing an entire season. So, yes, I'm surprised.
Paul, as an outsider, but also someone who is the former executive director of the NHLPA, what would you have done differently in this process up to this date?
Well, you know, it's a little bit of a dangerous question, and I don't want to be critical of either side here, and because everybody has their own style, and it would be hard to question either Don Seale or Gary Bettman, because they both obviously have long experience and you know, extensive backgrounds in labor law. But I think a couple of things I would have done differently. Number one, I certainly would have started the discussions a lot earlier, probably way back in at least January or February of last season. I would have done them very quietly. I would have tried to do it off the radar. You know, once you, of course, again, the executive director works for the players and really just is there to carry out the desires of the majority of the players, and so you would need to have taken time to educate the players and then get a consensus view of what the players wanted to do. But I would have tried to start the discussions earlier, and I think the second thing I would have done is avoided the kind of media volley that we've seen. I think that the dueling press conferences and, you know, casting aspersions on either side or the positions that the other side has taken, I don't think it's helpful to the process. I think that trying to keep those discussions, you know, more private would have been a prudent thing to do, because what you've seen develop here is a pretty poisonous relationship. And as the tensions rise and as players start, you know, sending imprudent emails and tweets about the other side out over the public airwaves, that just makes it more difficult for them to come to terms you know, so those are a couple of ways I would have approached it differently.
Paul, do you think there's too many people in the negotiating room right now?
Yeah, I don't know how many people are actually in the main room, but you're probably pretty right about that. I mean, in addition to having the two principals from either side, you probably have in-house lawyers, and then you've got outside lawyers, and of course, you've got PR people. You know, and then of course you've got players. I mean, I'm frankly very much in support of having players participate actively in the meetings and opening it up to any player who wants to attend. But it does make it more difficult, frankly, and it does change the dimension of the discussion when you have certain people in the room. I mean, I'm not sure you can say some of the things that you might want to say, or that you say them in the same way. Mm-hmm. If you have an audience of players and PR people, than you would if it was just a small group of 4 to 6 people. I know they've tried both approaches. I know they've had large groups, and I think they've also tried smaller groups. Again, but I would favor a smaller contingent of people.
We're joined on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show by Paul Kelly, the former executive director of the NHLPA. Paul, obviously not very many people have the experience in negotiating against or, you know, with Gary Bettman, as the case may be. You know, how would you describe his negotiation style?
Well, I mean, he's a smart guy, really very smart guy, and he picks up on issues. He's also been at this for 20 years. I mean, he's got the strong support of his ownership group. He has a constitutional setup, which doesn't require him to have the full backing of all 30 owners. He's got the very strong backing of his 8-person executive committee and probably solid backing from at least 2/3 of the team. So he goes into it with a confidence level. He also has leverage, frankly. He has more leverage than does Don Fehr. It's easier for the management side of the game, for the owners, to withstand a lockout than it is for players. And I think he recognizes all of those things. But I do think, I do follow some of the media that's been going on out there, and I know that Mr. Bevin has been vilified in the press and by the fans, particularly north of the border. And some of that is warranted, but those who don't believe that he's a supporter of the game or doesn't care about the development of the game and doesn't want to see the game back on the ice, well, they really don't know Gary. And having dealt with him, I don't believe any of that for a minute. I really do think he wants to see this thing solved. But he does have his marching orders, as does Don Fehr from his ownership side. And, he's clearly not going to bend on some of those key issues.
Paul, over the past 10 weeks, we've obviously heard a lot about Gary Bettman and we've heard a lot about Donald Fehr. But what about Bill Daly and Steve Fehr, and how big of a role do those two play?
I think bigger as time goes along. Don and Gary, they're kind of the face of their respective sides. I'm not sure a whole lot gets done when the two of them get in the room. If you remember the 04-05 lockout, it was really resolved by Bill Daly and at the time Ted Sask, and it wasn't Bob Goodenow and Gary Bettman. And I think, frankly, if you're going to solve this one, probably it's going to come down to Bill Daly and Steve Fehr. I mean, Bill Daly, I know Bill better than I know Steve, but Bill is a really smart guy, a little bit more of a kind of a people person than Gary Bettman is. He's an affable, well-liked person, both by not only by the owners but by the media and really by the players who get to know Bill. He's smart, but he's also reasonable. Bill, I think, recognizes when he has to give a little bit here and there, and so I think having him kind of take the lead would not be such a bad thing. Steve Fehr, I've had dealings with in the past, seems like a reasonable guy, a little bit more low-key than his brother, not the kind of, hard charger that you see when, Don's standing behind a podium and giving one of his press conferences, which comes across to a lot of people like a lecture. It's just a kind of style thing. So I think both Steve and Bill, could well be the key players as this thing moves along.
Well, in your experience, obviously, dealing with the players, from an outsider's point of view, we can't sometimes get a read on how many players are really actively involved in the process. I mean, I guess it's hard for you to maybe put a number on it. Maybe a percentage would be easier. But how many players are actively engaged on a, maybe not a day-to-day basis, but maybe a week-to-week basis in the process and how the Players Association is functioning?
I think clearly your negotiating committee is actively involved. If they're not on every call, they're on most every call, and they're certainly being filled in. So that's roughly 30 of your membership. And then you've had a number of additional players and some high-profile players. Sydney's been involved in, at least two or three of the meetings that I know of. Recently you saw Vinny LeCavalier, Marty St. Louis, appear in the meetings in New York. So, again, nearly half your membership, has gone overseas to play in Russia and over in Europe. And so of the guys that are back here, there may be as many as, 50 to 75 that are really paying close attention and, talking, participating in conference calls and the like. And that's a good thing. I mean, if you remember 04-05, it was a fairly small negotiating committee.
Right.
Actually boiled down to about 5 players, Billy Guerin and, Trevor Linden and those guys. And then, of course, when the players were dissatisfied with the end result, those guys took an awful lot of heat, much of which was unjustified, because it was a thankless task that they were involved in there in trying to bring an end to that last lockout. But so I think that Don, one of the things Don's done well here is not only educate the players, but get them all involved and make sure that the positions that he's taking, really do reflect the consensus of his membership.
You're listening to TSN 1290 and the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're joined by Paul Kelly. He's the former executive director of the NHLPA. Paul, the buzzword this weekend, in addition to turkey and tryptophan and stuffing, has been decertification. Would you recommend that the NHLPA decertify as a union?
That's a major step, really a major step. if you were going to decertify, you probably should have taken that step some time ago. I think to have waited this far along and then to talk about decertification as an option, I'm not sure it makes a great deal of sense, but you would clearly lose the entire remainder of the season, if not most of all of next season, if you put this into the courts, because what you're talking about is disbanding the union, at least in theory, and then filing lawsuits in various places seeking protection under the antitrust laws of the United States and Canada. It's far more complex in the hockey setting because, you do have franchises in both countries and citizens of both countries. And, unlike the NFL, where all of your franchises are based in the U.S., you really have a much more convoluted set of circumstances. It's a high-risk, high-stakes game. I mean, if you're the players and you decertify and you file this lawsuit, which takes a couple of years, and then at the end of the day, a court rules against you that you don't have, you haven't established the antitrust monopolistic practices. Now what have you gained? I mean, you've thrown the sport into complete, chaos. So if you're going to take that step, you really have to have determined that you have reached the end of the road, that there's just no other place for you to go, that you absolutely, under no circumstances, can negotiate any further and gain any additional concessions, and you can't accept what they put on the table. If that's the conclusion that you reach, then, that's one of the few options that you have left. But it's a really serious step, and I would hope we don't get there.
Paul, looking at it from a cost-benefit analysis, and obviously pride's on the line for both parties, and that's a factor in any negotiation, but if you look at it as the players maybe would be getting their fourth paycheck on November 30th, and if you take, just based on the math, $3.3 billion last year, and you cut it into each paycheck, it's possible that after waiting past November will cost the players more money than if they'd accepted an offer, say, three, four weeks ago from the NHL. How much do the numbers play into it in terms of overall dollar value in an offer as compared to maybe some issues within the actual collective bargaining agreement that they're probably not that comfortable with?
Yeah, I don't know at this point that it's really the dollars. First of all, the two sides don't agree on what the dollars. I mean, you keep hearing all week, Don Fear saying, we're only $182 million apart. I don't believe that the owners agree with that sentiment, but I don't think it's the numbers. I mean, I think that it's some of the contract issues and it's some of the clauses and requirements that the Players Association included in its proposal on Wednesday, including the one that said that, under no circumstances, in years 2 through 5, maybe, amount, the percentage that goes to the players, be any less than it was, in year 2. Mm-hmm. And then some other language in there that made it clear that, their proposal envisioned them only sharing in the upside with no sharing in the risk. So if there was a downturn in the American or the Canadian economy, or if the fans turned away in such a degree that, the revenues dropped from, say, $3.5 billion down to $3 billion flat, I mean, what would happen is that 50-50 split would no longer be 50-50, the percentage of the revenue under that kind of a scheme. So the players would go substantially higher. And so from the owner's perspective, they're not going to accept those types of clauses. It's not what they envision in the kind of 50-50 that they're proposing. So, I mean, one of the great frustrations that the players had in 0405 is that, they lost an entire season and then they ended up with a deal, frankly, that they could have had prior to the lost season. And then halfway through that lost season, they were told that, they would accept the salary cap when not only prior to that season, but for 2 years prior to that lost season, they kept hearing from the leadership, under no circumstances will we accept the cap. And, you know, there's a risk that the same thing could happen here. I mean, they may end up losing an entire season and then settling this thing in July, which is what happened after the 04-05 season, and end up with the exact same deal that was on the table today. And they will have lost their paychecks, which, of course, in most instances is in the millions of dollars, and the owners would have lost millions of dollars, and everybody will look back and say, what were we thinking? And, you know, that's why, you know, it's unfathomable to most of us that the parties don't realize what's at stake here and what they're losing and can't figure out some way to get together and make it work.
Paul, we've got one final question for you, and again, we appreciate you taking the time to come on A Legal Curve. You know, if you could pick one side, or, you know, your answer might be both sides, but, you know, to date, who do you think is more responsible for the CBA not getting done yet?
You know, I think it's a two-way street. There's no question about it. I mean, look, I'm a player's guy, and from the player's perspective, you know, they gave back a lot in the 04-05, you know, lost season in the last CBA, and there was a big rollback, and they changed the entire system, and they, you know, imposed some restrictions on the contract. And, of course, coming out of that, the players really felt that they had been defeated. You know, time has shown that, in fact, that CBA worked better for players, perhaps, than it did for owners, and a lot better for players than they thought coming out of the deal. You know, average salaries increased tremendously. You know, but again, the players now say, okay, wait a minute now. You know, here you want us to give back again after trumpeting, you know, 5 years of incredible advances and revenue generation and what a great success, you know, playoffs have been and the Winter Classic has been, and everything is rosy. And now it comes time to CBA negotiations, and you tell us, you know, it's doom and gloom, and, you know, three-quarters of the teams are doing okay, and a quarter are virtually bankrupt, and the players are going to have to, you know, step up and, you know, make major sacrifices. And so, you know, players have a difficult time with that whole approach and that whole story. And so, I mean, I think the NHL made a mistake coming out of the gates back in July with an offer that the players viewed as insulting, and it set a certain tone for these negotiations. But again, the players themselves, you know, I think the players want to play. I think you're starting to see some dissension in the ranks. You know, it's hard to keep 740 guys kind of all together on the same page. They've done a really masterful job of it to date. You lose another paycheck next week and then another one 2 weeks later, and again, it's going to be harder and harder to keep those players together in terms of this. So, you know, there's some responsibility that goes both ways here. I don't think you can point the finger at one side.
Paul Kelly, former executive director of the NHLPA, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We'll let you get back to your Thanksgiving weekend and your family. Much appreciated for your time.
Thanks, guys.
Take care, Paul. Thanks very much. Let's go to break. That was terrific. Some great insight that we can talk about after these commercial messages. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290.
The Big Show.